Thanks for being with us, everyone, tonight on Coast to Coast AM. We're exploring mysteries of the Amazon. In the next hour, we'll be joined by the gringo shaman Ron Wheelock and one of his pupils, star pupils, Victoria Alexander. This hour, we're talking with David Gran, who's written a remarkable book called The Lost City of Z about British explorer Percy Fawcett and his obsession with the mysteries of the Amazon. When we come back, although Fawcett was a man of science, he also had an interest in what we would call paranormal or the occult, and we'll explore that as well as how the legend of Atlantis fits into this tale. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. David Gran is my guest. He wrote this amazing book, The Lost City of Z. David, I don't want to get too far off the track about the city and your trip, but I was really surprised to find that a guy like Percy Fawcett, this model explorer, this man of science who was rigidly trained in the Royal Geographical Society in all sorts of scientific disciplines, had an interest in the occult. Tell me about it.
Yeah, he did. And part of it is, to kind of understand the time period a little bit, when Fawcett became interested in the occult, especially he had lived in Ceylon in the latter part of the 19th century, before he headed off to Brazil. He actually became a Buddhist. He was a very rebellious soul, very curious, and interest in spiritualism was very prevalent, actually, in Victorian society. And it was among some, but it wasn't seen by everybody as antithetical to science. There was actually a belief among many scientists that this was actually another frontier that science would help peel away. And so there was actually even the society set up for psychics to look into these things in London, which had a lot of Nobel Prize winners and famous writers. And one of the persons who Fawcett corresponded a lot with, and who he was believed to be the model for one of the characters in The Lost World, was Arthur Conan Doyle, who was also very interested in spiritualism. Now, there were kind of two big eras of spiritualism, and I don't want to get too bogged down, but after World War I, there was also another wave of interest in spiritualism, and this came from a real longing to speak with so many people who had perished. And Fawcett fought during World War I, and his interest in the occult intensified during that period.
Did he ever actually make contact or claim to make contact?
He did. I mean, he believed that he could communicate, and he would go to seances. And by the end of his life, in some ways, especially after World War I, he had been at the Battle of the Somme. And at the Battle of the Somme, it was one of the most horrific battles. On the first day of battle, some 20,000 British soldiers, most of them just kids, 16, 17, 18-year-old kids, were marched out of these trenches across the wasteland and into machine gun fire. Fawcett had been there, he had witnessed this, and for them that was really a collapse of Western civilization. And so Fawcett's notion of Z, in some ways, became more fantastical after World War I. And when you talked about this very pragmatic scientist who had put together his clues very scientifically, after World War I, his notions of Z became more grandiose. It became more of almost a counterpoint to what he had witnessed in Europe.
And wasn't it also true, I'm trying to remember from your book, that after he disappeared, after he presumably was dead, that his family and others tried to use seances to contact him?
That's right. Nina believed in it and attended seances. There were many, a very famous psychic in the day, a woman named E. Cummings, who would use automatic writing, wrote a famous book about Fawcett in its day, where she believed she was able to communicate and get his story about what really had happened to him. And many people attended seances trying to figure out what had happened to them. They were known as spiritual explorers, spiritual surveyors, and they would try to gather clues. And interestingly enough, to this day, when I was in Brazil, there's an area in the Mato Grosso region where a lot of mystics go. And in that area, there are various mystic groups that believe Fawcett had in fact found a portal to another dimension and still kind of, see in Fawcett, he's almost like a spiritual deity in some ways.
Wow, he really is an explorer if he found that. How does the story of Atlantis fit into this?
A Atlantis, in many ways, it's a little bit complicated, but this notion that the Amazon could support a complex society was seen as very unfathomable. And one of the reasons it was seen as unfathomable was because there were so many racist notions about what the Native Americans were capable of. And so one theory, Fawcett, who had grown up with all these kind of racist attitudes, was convinced when he was on the ground that the Native populations he found were very sophisticated, had advanced cultures. He was very impressed by many of the societies that he lived with and stayed with. And yet, in some ways, he to try to explain it, he sometimes thought, well, maybe they are descendants of Atlantis. Maybe that would explain that there was some European origin that would explain why these populations could have been sophisticated. And so it was for a way for him to try to square this kind of racial box he was in.
And then after he's gone, there are stories periodically popping up about white Indians, presumably his offspring.
That is right. There was, in fact, missionaries in the 40s and 50s and the late 30s began to head into some of these areas, and there began to emerge reports and rumors of a young white Indian boy staying with the Kikuru Indians, a tribe that I eventually stayed with. And eventually this boy was taken out of the jungle. He was believed to be Fawcett's grandson. They thought it was Jack's son. And he was known as the white god of the Xingu, because this was in the Xingu area of the Amazon. And he was actually, it's very sad, he was kind of paraded around almost like a circus freak, this kind of curiosity. People were lining up to watch films. There were early films of him. And eventually it was revealed that he was an albino.
Oh, clearly not not what
clearly
they...
not Fawcett's offspring, no.
Let's pick up the trail with pick up the story with your pursuing the trail. What did you find? What's your best guess about what happened to Fawcett, and what do you base that on?
Well, various clues led me to believe that he was likely killed by a tribe not far from the Xingu River, a little bit east of the Xingu River, heading towards a river that's known as the River of Death. And I based that on a few critical clues. One is it's very unlikely that Fawcett would have starved. By that point of his career, he was extraordinarily adept at living off the land. He was a survivor. He'd adopted many of the indigenous techniques to living off the jungle. So starvation was very unlikely. While disease is a possibility, the likelihood that all three of them would have succumbed to disease also is unlikely. And then the final and the most important clue was when I eventually stayed with the Kalapalo Indians, which is a tribe in the Xingu, to my amazement, even though they don't have written records, they have oral histories. And these oral histories get passed down for generations. It's the way they preserve their past. And they had an oral history about Fawcett because they were among the first white men they had ever seen. And what's amazing about this oral history is it includes details about Fawcett that I only knew about because I had Fawcett's last letters home to Nina, including the fact that he had brought this little musical recorder, like a flute-like thing, and he had written his wife, Nina, saying, I'm bringing this with me so that I won't go mad in the solitude of the jungle. And in this oral history, it actually describes Fawcett playing this instrument. And in that oral history, it describes how Fawcett had insisted on heading east, and the Kalapalos tried to dissuade them from heading in that direction, saying in that area is what they referred to as the fierce Indians, a group of Indians that the Kalapalos, who are a very peaceful group, were very afraid of. And Fawcett insisted on going that way. And for several days, the Kalapalos described seeing Fawcett's fire rising above the canopy. And then after 5 days, the fire extinguishes as if it had been snuffed out. And they go to inspect the area, and they are gone. And nothing remains, and there's no evidence of them. And they were convinced in this oral history, and the Kalapalos know that area better than anyone, that the Indians, these fierce Indians, had killed the party.
And this is the kind of story, I mean, they're not just telling the gringo what he wants to hear. It is the kind of story that really would live on in oral traditions.
Yes, very much so. And like I said, it had enough clues in it that that details that, because I only knew them, that were verifiable, that gave me a lot of credence, gave me a lot to posit, gave a lot of credibility to their story.
And why would this tribe have killed him? What would be the range of reasons, or did they even need one?
Sure. They were Hugh Fawcett, who had always been able to establish peaceful contact. In the area where they were heading was the Xavante Indians. And the Xavante Indians were a group that the Brazilian government had tried to acculturate several years earlier and actually moved into camps and settlements. And they were treated horrifically and died of disease and eventually fled back into the forest. And they vowed to let nobody come in that area. And in fact, there's a long history of people who had tried to cross into those territories who were killed. And so even though Fawcett had a long, strong history of establishing peaceful contact, he was heading into an area that was extraordinarily dangerous.
Let's talk about the Lost City of Z. I mean, you don't have something where you can point, aha, exactly, that is exactly it, and I know it beyond all doubt, but even Fawcett found indications that there really could have been these large civilizations, higher ground, I guess, clearings, settlements where there might have been a couple of thousand people in each.
That's right. Eventually, I had pushed towards the Quicurus, where they had found this, at one point, this white child, this albino. And when I was there, I had met up with an archaeologist, a man named Michael Heckenberger, who had spent more than a decade doing intensive research in that area. And at one point, he had led me into the forest where there was a large moat in the earth, and it was partly excavated. And I asked him what it was. And he said, well, he had done carbon dating on it. I think this part of the moat was about 1200 AD. And I said, well, why is there a moat in the middle of nowhere? And he said, you're actually standing in a pre-Columbian settlement. And he and his team, including he worked closely with the chief of the Quicurus, a man named Afukaka, have found evidence of 20 pre-Columbian settlements. And these settlements had a population, as you said, between about 2,500 to about 5,000 people. They were connected. There were several of them, and they were connected by roads built at right angles. And he had found evidence of a bridge that had crossed the riverway, and he had found lots of ancient pottery. The settlements were dated between, and I'm pretty sure it was 600 AD, it may have been 800 AD, but I believe it was 600 AD to into the 1500s, which gets back to your earlier point of, could disease have wiped these people out? Well, the fact that these ancient settlements date to the 1500s, well, what happened in the 1500s? That was when the first...
We arrived.
We arrived, exactly. I mean, it's too coincidental, and this is the most logical explanation. And what's amazing is that even though conquistadors had headed into an area very far from this, it shows how quickly the disease had spread in these areas.
Tell me this. How resistant – I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and Heckenberger isn't alone. So we have this settlement here, and this is in the very area where Fawcett believed he would find Z and where he disappeared. We're finding these evidence. And there are many other discoveries now just in the last few years using satellite imagery and ground-penetrating radar. I had described earlier these enormous earth mounds in the Bolivian floodplains that Fawcett had climbed. That's where he saw shards of pottery, and he had described seeing these causeways buried underneath the undergrowth of the forest. Well, an archaeologist from the University of Pennsylvania, a man named Clark Erickson, has looked at many of these earth mounds and has concluded, in fact, they were man-made and that they were connected by causeways and roadways. They had elaborate irrigation ditches, and that these earth mounds, although it's somewhat mysterious their purpose, were most likely at least partly built to elevate themselves above some of the flooding so that you could grow crops. And he has compared the labor and the engineering that went into these earth mounds to the Egyptian pyramids. And one of the things that's interesting is that these ruins slightly go against what we would think of, because they are not made of stone. There's not a lot of stone in the jungle. And it's one of the reasons they have been consumed so quickly.
Tell me this. Heckenberger, you know, you mentioned him throughout the book, and he was very helpful to you. But I wonder how resistant to this view mainstream science has been. I guess probably it's continued and maybe still continues.
Yes. I mean, and one of the things we should mention is that when Fawcett went, I mean, and this is a really important part of the story, Fawcett, who had once been a celebrated figure, when he came up with his theory, met a lot of resistance and would bang against the scientific establishment, who believed that the jungle had to be a counterfeit paradise, this place that couldn't support a civilization. And he met enormous resistance. And for most of the 20th century, the Amazon was known as this term, this counterfeit paradise. That was a phrase coined by the most famous archaeologist, influential archaeologist in the Amazon, a woman named Betty Meggers. And so when Heckerberger set out, he never expected to find these things, and there was enormous resistance. And in fact, very few archaeologists went into the Amazon because people kind of thought there was nothing there. So anthropologists would go in to kind of maybe get oral traditions, but the notion of kind of going in to try to find actually archaeological ruins was not something until very recently. And the discoveries, though, in the last few years, and there was a fierce fight in the scientific establishment between some of these revisionists like Heckenberger and the traditionalists, I would say the number of discoveries now has really started to shift that debate. And, for example, a few months ago, a scientist, partly because of deforestation, using satellite imagery, had found these enormous geometric earthworks. And if somebody should try to look at these photos, if they can find them online, because they're quite extraordinary. They look like they're these enormous trenches. They're about 30 feet wide, and they extend. They look like enormous squares and triangles and circles diagrammed into the earth. They look almost like a geometric equation. They're spread out over an area more than 150 kilometers. And archaeologists, because of the similar design, they estimate the population may have been as large as 60,000. Which would have made it much larger than many medieval European cities. And the carbon dating on some of these goes back 300 BC. So these discoveries are really shifting this debate, but it's happening quickly and suddenly. And even this notion, for example, that there was no stone in the Amazon, and most of these remnants we're finding, that art scientists are finding, are not made of stone. And yet, not too long ago, people found what is being described as the Stonehenge of the Amazon, where there is a stone site. It looks almost like it was probably astronomical and had some purpose. And so what scientists are essentially saying is, well, we still don't know much about these civilizations, and we're only at the very beginning of this revolution. The idea that the jungle did not contain advanced civilizations, I think, is quickly becoming a dying notion.
Well, this idea that archaeologists haven't found it necessary to go into the jungle, there's all kinds of reasons not to go into the jungle,
yeah,
and you found out
too.
Those. You discovered those. I mean, you came out unscathed, right?
I did come out unscathed. I was a bit sick, which I try not to go too much into the book because I didn't want to, you know, focus so much on that. But I did get a little bit sick. But I did come out unscathed, and there was one point on my trip where I became separated from my guide, and I was lost, and it was a short period, but it did give me some sense of the terror and what it really was like for Fawcett.
And would you go again if there was a reason for it?
You know, it's interesting. When I got done, I said never again, and I really did not think I would go again. But some of these latest discoveries are very intriguing and tantalizing to me, and so I am considering for the first time possibly another expedition, especially looking at some of these geometric earthworks that I described.
We posted an article on the Coast to Coast website tonight, images taken from Google Earth, and I think they're the same ones you're talking about, large rectangular things. Yeah.
Oh, terrific. Yeah, because it's just fascinating. And I mean, and again, you know, the purpose of these things are still unknown, and I don't think we will, you know, we're now making these discoveries, and so we're knowing there was something there. We are knowing there were larger populations. They're finding throughout the Amazon what's called black earth. Black earth is a really interesting thing. Black earth is produced from organic waste. If you have a settlement and throw things into the soil, it gets nutrients. And that means that people lived and inhabited those areas. And we're finding lots of this black earth now in the Amazon.
Hold that thought, David. We need to take a break. When we come back, I want you to tell us more about black earth. And then I want to also get into your newest book, The Devil and Sherlock Holmes. And we'll be opening up the phone line so that our listeners can ask you some questions as well. Stay with us for more Coast to Coast AM. So glad you're with us tonight, everyone. Coming up in hours 3 and 4, I'll be joined by the Gringo Shaman Ron Wheelock and his pupil Victoria Alexander to speak about inner mysteries of the Amazon, what we have plenty of time left for with David Gran, author of The Lost City of Z. And I can't tell you enough about this book. I mean, it's easily one of the best books I've read on any topic in a long time. And we'll be opening up the phone lines with your questions for David right after this. Stay with us on Coast to Coast. We have some time left with David Gran, my guest tonight, who wrote The Lost City of Z, as well as another book I want to touch on in a minute or two, The Devil and Sherlock Holmes. David, before we leave the Amazon here, you know, this search for Z sort of began as a search for El Dorado, a city of gold. And I know there was gold in Peru and there was gold in Mexico that explorers found. Is there gold in the Amazon? Did anybody ever find gold to any degree?
You know, it's a good question. There is certainly gold in the Amazon, and gold has been mined in the Amazon and in rivers, and there are plenty of people who have searched for gold. There has not yet been found any evidence of this kind of golden city where there was kind of so much gold, where we found kind of gold statues or anything like that. That has yet to be found. I suspect it was exaggerated and somewhat of a romance, although I would say this, that, you know, so many things that we thought were impossible have since been discovered. So I'm also very careful and cautious about saying that anything at this point is impossible.
You know, you see, as we mentioned earlier, Google Earth has photos from space. Even in Fawcett's time, there was the airplanes were coming into the exploration game. It sort of takes, I guess, some of the romance out of it, but it also takes out things like cannibals and exposure to disease and things like that.
Yes, it certainly makes it much easier. And one of the interesting things was that when Fawcett went, it really was, he did really represent a certain end. And his main rival in his day was a man named Hamilton Rice. And Hamilton Rice was really kind of, if Fawcett represented kind of the end of 19th century expeditions, Hamilton Rice was kind of a harbinger of what was to come. And he, as you mentioned, brought the first airplanes into the Amazon that would land these kind of land on platoons and the pontoons in the riverway.
Let's go to the phones. West of the Rockies, Jacob in Susanville, California. Hi, Jacob.
Hey.
Hey.
I was just wondering, what are the squares in the Amazon meant for?
You mean these square geometrical shapes that have been found?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think with a lot of these things, scientists still don't know. They do not yet know what the purpose of this. Was there some astronomical purpose to some of these sites? Where they have these trenches built in the shape, scientists still do not yet know the purpose of them.
Like Nazca, David, do you have any theories on that? Maybe we should unleash you on that one.
Maybe that'll become my next project.
Any thoughts? Same thing?
No, I don't know. I haven't done I mean, I know of it, but I've never done enough research to have any kind of a hypothesis on it.
Jacob, are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay. Is that, was that your question?
Yes.
Okay. David, you know, let's talk about the Amazon for a second, what's happened to it. I imagine you had to see some of it down there. We hear different stories about the deforestation, and it becomes a political argument. It's greatly exaggerated. It's not that bad. It's the environmentalists who are using this for their own political purposes. What did you see? Not only what's happening to the forest, but to the peoples out there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I had my view is very micro in that it's kind of what I saw and experienced. And so, as I described, I would bring Fawcett's letters with me. And early in my trip, I would be reading Fawcett's letters where he would be describing kind of hacking through the wilderness. Raleigh at that point was very sick. And I would look out in some of these areas, and there was literally nothing there. It looked like Nebraska. I mean, all these areas have been cut down as far as you could see to the horizon, and were being converted into soybean farms. Interestingly enough, the areas where the forest remains greatest is in these indigenous areas. And so once I went into the Xingu area, where Heckenberger was doing his research, there the forest it remains, and it remains intact. But many of the native populations, these indigenous communities, feel constantly threatened under assault from loggers coming in and deforesting the surrounding area. There was a dam being built downriver from where the Xingu area, and when I was there, some of the tribes were very worried about what that would mean to their way of life.
You ever hear any stories about Fawcett reporting giants, strange tribes, strange people out there?
Yeah, his accounts, it's interesting. Fawcett's accounts of the tribes he would meet are very well observed, and he would describe, people as you would imagine. Sometimes tribes that he would hear about that were kind of beyond were filled more with legend, and sometimes they probably had some basis. Like he would describe there was a tribe of very small people in some of his writings, and that quite likely could have been the Yanomami or some of these other tribes that are much shorter in stature that might have come from. So the tribes that he encountered, he never described tribes that he encountered being either enormous giants or small in stature, but he would often describe hearing legends of such people, in the distance.
Yeah, I read this account, and you're not too harsh on him. You're very realistic in painting a picture of what kind of guy he was. I mean, if he were in an officer, say, in Vietnam, he'd be the kind of guy that might get fragged, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. He was a tough bugger, and he was he was also very contemptuous of some of the people who went with him. He never let anything stand in his way. And he's a very eccentric character. He was a complex individual.
Contemptuous in the way of if somebody couldn't keep up with him, and he was maniacal in this.
They just
weren't worth going along.
That's right. I mean, he saw weakness as almost a measure of your character.
Okay, let's shift gears for a second. The Devil and Sherlock Holmes. This is your more recent book, Tales of Murder, Madness, and Obsession. Tell me about it.
Yeah, well, there's a wonderful connection here. This is a dozen stories, all true stories, all mysteries, elements of intrigue, characters who in many ways are sleuths trying to kind of figure out what's going on in their life. There's a story about a con man who suddenly suspects he may be the one who is being conned. There's a story of a Polish detective. Again, these stories are all true, but there's a story of a Polish detective who is investigating whether a postmodern novelist has planted clues to an actual murder in his book. And the title of the book comes from a story about the death of the world's greatest Sherlock Holmes scholar, the mysterious death. This man was found garroted. And interestingly enough, it was in the course of researching that, where I was reading everything about Conan Doyle, that I came across Fawcett's name, which actually led to The Lost City of Z.
And this one hasn't been bought up by Brad Pitt already, has it?
It hasn't been bought up, but several of the stories actually have been bought up by others.
Well, best of luck to you. Maybe I haven't read it yet, but I look forward to reading it, and maybe we can have you back on. I'm going to go back to the phones. First-time caller, Steve in Highland Falls, New York. Hi, Steve.
Good evening. How are you doing, guys?
Okay.
Awesome. I'm actually a fan of Fawcett's for a little bit of a different reason, and I apologize if you spoke about this because I missed the first hour of the radio program, gentlemen. Fawcett, his son Brian actually published a lot of his memoirs in Britain, and he was credited, and he is known throughout the Herpetological Society for encountering giant snakes in the Amazon. And in 1907, near the Rio Abuna in Brazil, he claimed to have encountered a 50 to 60 foot anaconda. He was also involved with the sighting of what is not credited as being the world's largest snake, but it's given some credence in herpetological and zoological societies.
Actually, David writes about that. You write about the snake, right?
That's right. I do. I write about the snake. And in fact, there's a drawing I also include from the son, Brian, who imagined this encounter with a snake. And Fawcett had reported this snake, part of it being submerged, and he estimated, I think you said it was 57 or 59 feet.
It was phenomenal. And then he was shot down. Actually, his son Brian actually had to defend him in Britain because they tried to bash his dad and his family name, and he staunchly defended him, and it was a phenomenal story. There's other stories of him encountering crazy wildlife and other things like that, and I just wanted to call and comment on that. And thank you, sir. You take care, gentlemen.
I mean, the snake is an interesting thing because, you know, I interviewed a lot of, I don't even know what the term is for snake experts. Maybe what he said, that word.
Herpetologist,
that,
I guess.
Is that what it is? Maybe it's herpetologist, but who, or zoologist, who said that, you know, the largest anaconda, I think, on record, I mean, there are different estimates, but I think it's about 27, 28 feet, where scientists say, you know, that is for factually accurate. And so did Fawcett see one this big? Did he exaggerate? Did it seem that big? You know, we just don't know for sure.
You were guessing in the book that maybe it was 27, 28 feet long, something like that. It was submerged.
Because there's been no recorded account of a snake, of an anaconda, you know, more than 30 feet.
And but so, hey, man, 27, 28 feet, that's a big snake.
That would seem damn big to me. It would make me run the other way.
Yeah, I'd get out of the water right about there. West of the Rockies, Brad in Utah. Hi, Brad.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay.
Excellent program tonight. A question for your guest. In your research going into either Fawcett's writings or other sources, did you uncover any mention of underground tunnels? That's something that shows up every now and then on the internet of vast, ages-old underground tunnels that stretch all the way south along the Andes to the Atacama Desert. And I wondered if you found any evidence that substantiated that in the maps or the notes that Fawcett, had.
Or maybe to expand the question as well, Brad, any kind of underground installations or buildings or homes or whatever?
I did not find any evidence of this, and I don't believe that I found descriptions. I'm trying to search my memory now. Did Fawcett in any kind of passing? I do not recall Fawcett describing such a place. But when I described earlier these mystics who I met up with in the Brazilian Amazon, they believe very much in this, that this exists and that there's a portal under there and that this elaborate network of tunnels exists. I never saw any evidence of it. People who, a lot of mystics believe Fawcett did find such a place and it led to a portal, but I never found any evidence of this. But I spoke with people who very much believe that.
Brad, thanks for the call. East of the Rockies, Michael in Texas. Hi, Michael.
Hi. Great to talk to you. Enjoying the show immensely. I've been an Amazon guide since 1989.
Wow.
I'm up here with my father for he's in doing medical therapy and stuff like that. You were talking about snakes a while ago. In 1914, Teddy Roosevelt, of course, put up a reward for $50,000 for any snake over 10 meters long.
Right.
It's not being claimed yet.
And Roosevelt was down there, right? He was down there.
Oh, yeah, he was. River of Death was a book that featured him in it, and we did a lot of research down there looking for the snakes. And getting back to Fawcett, of course, one of the biggest airlines out of Peru was Fawcett Airlines.
That's right.
And great little airlines. Unfortunately, they went bankrupt.
And, named for Fawcett?
Yeah, it was named for Fawcett.
Named for Fawcett, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was actually an international airline. It flew from Iquitos, out of right there in the heart of the Amazon, to Miami nonstop.
And when you look on some maps, too, like you talk a little bit about the legacy of Fawcett's legend. We talked a little bit about that. But there's a part in the Brazilian area where Fawcett's map that still appears on the map as often as Fawcett Country.
Right, exactly. And we're based out of Iquitos. And we were the first people to go in and make the first outsiders to go in and make a contract with the Guanani Nation. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
Yes, I am, yeah.
Yeah, we were the first outsiders to go in and make a contract with them. And our contract included that we would train them in tourism to free them from the oil companies and lumber companies, and to make them independent of them. And after 5 years of employing them and teaching them in tourism, ecotourism, we turned our company over to them and then moved out of Ecuador and into Peru. And we were some of the pioneers in ecotourism down there. You mentioned something about cleared areas like the size of the state of Nebraska down in, I guess, in Brazil. I'm not familiar with that. I've been all the way from the Ucayali, where the Ucayali and the Maranhão meet, all the way down the Amazon to Belém to the island till we tasted salt water, and then flew back crisscrossing the Amazon up from there. Where is that area located at?
That area is in the Mato Grosso area.
That's farther south.
Yeah, it's farther south, and it's Mato Grosso actually means dense forest, but it's an area where the Brazilians have developed a lot of soybean farms.
Right, exactly. We were also one of the first people to ever go in and do reforestation in the Amazon in the early 70s.
And how's that going?
It's going great. Of course, it put us out of business. Everybody said that, you'll never make any money out of that. Well, after the first year and a half, everybody said, wow, they're making money. And, so we got out of the business because we couldn't make any money at it anymore, but everybody else got in there trying to make money. And it's wonderful to hear you on there, and I'll pick up your book.
Yeah,
and,
thank you.
If I could possibly, do you have a website by any chance?
I do, davidgrand.com. I think it's on the show's website too, I believe.
Okay, great. I'll get in touch with you.
Sounds good.
Okay,
thanks, Michael. Thanks. Appreciate the call. You know, you wonder, he was talking about tourism and the opportunities for ecotourism. There's all kinds of stuff, I guess, that could be left to discover there. I mean, as you mentioned, I mean, it's not like it was in Fawcett's day, but there's a heck of a lot of territory down there that that humans have, at least Westerners, have not been on the ground and looking around, medicine possibilities, other kinds of discoveries.
Without question. I mean, these discoveries, too, are coming very fast in the last few years. And, you know, what people forget often is just how enormous and a vast terrain we're talking about. It's literally, the Amazon basin, it's about the size of the continental United States.
Wow. I wonder, David, if now the success of your book and the impending movie, if you were basically going to set off a new round of Fawcett Freaks.
Well, my hope is that I've kind of, in reading the book, have cast enough light on these mysteries that I would be the last Fawcett Freak, but somehow I doubt that, and I suspect there will be others soon marching off.
Yeah, I would imagine there will be people showing up at the Royal Society. I see the notebooks? And
I suspect so.
And driving them crazy.
I suspect so. And I get, to be honest, I get a fair amount of emails from people saying, I'm ready to go, give me coordinates.
Really? I mean, tell me about a little bit about the reaction to the book. It's been out for a while now, and I'm sure it's done well to be picked up for a movie, but what it's been like, the kinds of fan mail or hate mail that you get.
You never know when you do these things, and, you know, there's always an element of trepidation when you spend many years on this, and then you release it. And for the most part, the reception has been a very positive. And I think, you know, part of it is, and I think just, you know, in our conversation is that, and one of the things that drew me to this story is that it just taps into a lot of our myths. And it is at some level a great story and a great yarn. And I think we all, you know, have these kind of desires to kind of see what's on the other side of the horizon. And then I think this element, of these discoveries, which we're only at the beginning of, not only are transforming our view of fossil, but they're really transforming our understanding of what the Americas looked like before Columbus. So, for the most part, I've been very gratified in the response.
David Grand, thanks very much. The book is called The Lost City of Z. I sure recommend it for anyone who's interested in this sort of thing. And David, I hope we can have you back on some other time.
It was my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks very much.
Okay.
Thanks. The Gringo Shaman, Ron Wheelock, and Victoria Alexander. To continue our theme about mysteries of the Amazon, coming up right after this break. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM.